Hello and welcome to our Food Principles module, topic on elimination diets. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to present this information to you because it's something you are going to see and probably use a lot in your practice with folks. Elimination diets are commonly employed for lots of different reasons, and today's presentation is going to talk about what elimination diets are, when you can use them, what some of the downsides and problems that can happen with putting people through elimination diets, and also providing you with some tools and resources that you can do to help people, guide people through an elimination diet. Before we begin, we're going to just say that everything that I share with you and everything you share with your clients is not intended as medical advice. It's strictly intended as education. And it is with the intent that you empower your clients to be able to make their own decisions about their health from an informed place. And of course, if they're under the care of a doctor on any prescription medication, they always need to run whatever changes they're doing by that prescribing doctor. So let's just start with elimination diets. We'll talk about what they are. We'll talk about what some of the common ones that you would hear about. But when you're hearing about different types of diets, you may hear about people on a gluten-free diet, people on a casein-free diet, people on a gluten-free casein-free diet, often fondly called the GFCF diet, and a nightshade-free diet. In fact, these are just a small subset of all the different types of elimination diets you can have. You can be eliminating a group of foods from your client's diet and monitoring in the same way, regardless of what it is that you're trying to accomplish with that elimination diet. Oftentimes we do elimination diets for short periods of time, like 4 days, but we could do them for longer periods of time of 3 weeks up to 3 months, depending on the severity and the circumstances. So these are the common ones that you'll hear about, and let's just jump in and talk about what elimination diets are, when you would do an elimination diet, and how to do an elimination diet, and even better, how do you then do the provocation that needs to follow the elimination diet in order to identify those foods that are not working properly. So an elimination diet is basically just exactly what it means. We're eliminating certain foods from the diet for a short to a long period of time to see how the person does without that food or group of foods. And then very strategically adding those foods back while monitoring as you go to see if that particular food or food group might have been a problem that was a contributing culprit in their specific situation that they're trying to resolve. So there's a lot of indications for going on an elimination diet, for putting someone on an elimination diet. One is the obvious allergic symptoms. They're sniffly, they're sneezy, they've got hives, skin rashes, anything that looks like an external histamine reaction, which is that swelling and redness that occurs when histamines are produced. That's the obvious. And usually, you know, it happens where somebody says, you know, every time I eat, I get this reaction. It could be a generic histamine reaction, which we talk about in the other module that is on histamine, but it could be a specific histamine reaction in response to a specific food or set of foods. The other kind of conditions where it's very common to do and very effective to do an elimination diet to determine the culprits are things like atopic conditions, allergically, immunologically induced rashes on the skin and in other areas. Asthma. Kids who have asthma, very common that there's a food allergy, a food sensitivity component to it. We also see it used a lot in the autistic spectrum disorders, autism, Asperger's. ADHD is sometimes considered part of that disorder and sometimes not. So I took it off and put it separately, but attention problems, focus problems, fidgety. When people have these particular symptoms or conditions, there's very often an underlying food sensitivity that's contributing to it. And doing an elimination diet is going to help the person to identify that. unexplained symptoms that don't resolve as you expect. You put somebody on a particular program, you remove a couple of foods or you add a couple of nutrients, you change what they're doing, and all the things that you're doing are quote unquote right for what is going on with the person, but they're just not getting resolved. There's still some unexplained symptoms. Oftentimes there's an underlying food sensitivity that needs to be identified through an elimination diet. And finally, I'm just saying this because it's very common, the inability to release weight after somebody has reduced their calories, increased their exercise, gotten rid of the junk, balanced their blood sugar, and they're still stuck at a certain weight. Very often that can be an underlying food allergy or sensitivity. And there's a book called The False Fat Diet by Dr. Elton Haas. And he talks a lot about those hidden food sensitivities that cause the people to retain weight. Part of that reason is when you have a reaction to certain foods, you have this histamine reaction or you have an inflammatory reaction. And oftentimes it's a systemic reaction and there's a lot of internal swelling in the body. It's real obvious when somebody has swollen hands or swollen ankles, puffy face, but sometimes that inflammation is occurring inside and around the organs and it presents as extra weight that just won't go away. And it's going to be volume as well. So if you've got a lymphatic swelling that happens as a result of a food sensitivity and it's in the gut and all the little lymph nodes in the gut get swollen to try to fight that off, then that's going to severely enlarge the size and the breadth of the gut. So it's a lot of reasons. This is just some of them. And there's indications all over that, if you don't get rid of the foods that are causing a problem, there may be more of a problem. Now, that said, what do we attribute to such a predominance of food allergic symptoms we see today in our society? Well, a lot of times it's related. In fact, most of the times it's related, especially if it's multiple sensitivities, to a leaky gut. And you've got plenty of resources to teach you how to solve a leaky gut. And that's the thing that has to be done either prior to or in conjunction with an elimination diet. Super, super important. You can do all the elimination and provocation you want, but if you don't fix the underlying cause or help your client to fix the underlying cause, you're not going to get to the root. So really very much entrenched in working with somebody and putting them on elimination diet, you've got to do all the pieces. You don't just eliminate foods. I've seen that happen where people come in and they have this list of foods that's miles long that they've been eliminating for years and they're wondering why do they still have symptoms, hardly eating anything. But they haven't really addressed the underlying cause of those food sensitivities. Now, that all said, there are some that are born in. There are some that are programmed in from birth and that's the way it is. It goes that way. I've seen that happen. So what really is a food sensitivity? And I keep saying the word sensitivity, and the reason is so many people use the word food allergy incorrectly. So let's define some terms before we go too much further. A food sensitivity is the body's response to a normally harmless substance as if it were a threat, and it tries to attack it and get rid of it. So let's look at food allergy versus food intolerance. They all go under the umbrella of a sensitivity where that particular food triggers a response that person's sensitive to. That person doesn't treat it as if it's a food that's going to nourish and support them. It treats it as if it's the enemy. With a food allergy, there's an immune system response to the food. The body produces antibodies to attack that food. It could be immediate or delayed. Immediate example is somebody eats a couple of strawberries and they get hives all over. A delayed is that somebody eats something they're sensitive to and just start to feel kind of low and headachy and not so good and symptoms arise, but it's over a course of several hours up to several days. In a food intolerance, there's no immune system response. It's not that the body's attacking it. There's some reason, usually some sort of chemical constituent. We've talked about some of those in the other food principles sections. So sensitivity to salicylates, sensitivity to oxalates, okay? So if in that case, it's dose dependent. A person can usually eat a small amount of that food with no reaction, but when there's an accumulation of whatever that constituent is that's bothering them, then they get a reaction. So the immune system isn't involved. Whereas with food allergy, in most cases, it doesn't take more than even a tiny bit, especially in a severe allergic response, to give that person the reaction. So in food allergy, we're completely eliminating those particular foods for some length of time, thus an elimination diet. With food intolerance, it's very helpful to be eliminating foods completely for a while and then retesting them. But sometimes a person can get away with a teeny tiny bit of it without messing up the test. So let's just review a little bit about the immune system's job, just enough for you to understand what's going on in this food allergy reaction. And we'll get way deeper into the immune system in the immune system module. So what is this? We protect, the immune system's job is to protect us from foreign invaders. Those invaders are called antigens. Okay, those are the bullets. And then the immune system is the police department and the army. It's protecting. Okay, there come the bullets. Let's shield them. Let's push them away. Let's get rid of this. Or destroy the enemy, the antigen. So a lot of different things can be antigens, bacteria, viruses, fungi, yeast, molds, pollen, food particles. The top ones I just mentioned, those are the ones we see most commonly and we associate with the immune system, right? The body's getting rid of microbes. The body's getting rid of pollen. But truly, pollen is really an allergy, right? Because it's a response to something that really isn't dangerous. The response to the bacteria and viruses and yeast and fungi and molds usually is because those things can be dangerous if they get into the body. Pollen is really not dangerous and food is not, except when the food is in the wrong place, which is what usually happens with food allergies and food sensitivities, is there's a leaky gut, a disruption of the membrane in the gut, and the particles get into the bloodstream. First of all, they're not that well digested, so digestion is another piece you have to address as well as the rest of it. So you have to address the digestion and the state of the digestive tract, the absorption, in order to help someone with food allergies. So they're not producing enough enzymes, stomach acid, they're eating too fast, they're not chewing. Large particles of that food is going to escape the body's natural breakdown mechanisms, the enzymes, the HCL. And those particles are going to pass through that gut because the gut is hyperpermeable. All this contributes to food allergies and leads us to need to do a food elimination diet. Of course, there's other things, dirts, parasites, environmental toxins that the immune system responds to. What we're talking about today is going to be the food particles. This is just a summary of some of the antibodies. We'll go more depth of this into the NEPT immune system module, but the IgGs and the IgM antibodies, immunoglobulin M, immunoglobulin D, those are considered the first line. They get in at first. Most prevalent is the IgG. And IgG is implicated in delayed hypersensitivity reactions. IgA lines the mucosal surfaces. It's in the serum, it's in the secretion, it's in the nasal passages, the respiratory tract, the vagina, the gut. And then IgE is mainly in the respiratory and GI mucosa, and it's responsible for the immediate hypersensitivity. So the person that eats a strawberry and gets hives is an IgE-mediated food allergy. Okay, and that's also implicated in asthma, hay fever, and other environmental type allergies where people smell the grass, they start to sneeze. They go by a cat, they touch a dog, and they start to sneeze and get a reaction. I just thought this was important to get the background, review some of this. This is from our fatty acids module, but this is where the inflammatory cascades happen, the mast cells that produce histamine. And the person can be overproducing the histamine if their fats are out of balance, if the nutrients that support them in anti-inflammatory mechanisms are out of balance. And this should look familiar to you. the nutritional modulation. So this is a good chart to print out and keep handy because it's going to be working with people with arthritis and autoimmune diseases and any kind of inflammatory condition, including food allergies. So keep in mind this chart, you need the good omega-3s, you need all the nutrients to help the conversion. You need to stay away from the things that contribute to putting on the fire. So some of the common indications that you're going to see beyond what I talked about in terms of the big stuff for doing an elimination diet is food allergy symptoms. And it's not just a matter of eating a food and getting a stomach ache or sneezing or sniffling or getting all red and itchy. It's a matter of other things as well. So headaches, rashes, brain fog, constipation, diarrhea, GI upset, depression, lack of focus, anxiety, fatigue, and a whole lot more. They can all be attributed to an issue with food. Inability to focus, depression, all of these things can be related to foods. And what we're here to talk about today is how do you help the person design an elimination diet so that they can rid their body of those symptoms, heal their gut, optimize their digestive function, and then reintroduce those foods. Problem with a lot of folks in doing elimination diets is they get the person off all these foods, but then they don't do the gut healing and the gut optimization before they start to do the provocation. So that gut healing needs to be happening. It can be happening before the elimination, during the elimination, and certainly after. By after the elimination, you've got to be working on that gut before you do the provocation. So that often dictates how long that provocation period is going to be and how long that elimination period is going to be. Right? So if somebody has a lot of symptoms and they've had a lot of gut issues and you work on the gut issues and then you take them off the foods, but you haven't resolved the gut issues, you're going to have to have them off of those foods a lot longer than if somebody has worked on their gut and they've done a parasite protocol and they've gotten rid of a lot and they've healed up the lining as best they can. And then they do this elimination. They're going to have to be off those foods a lot less. So you've heard this before, the most common allergens, gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. And the runners up, which we hear about a lot, shellfish, tree nuts, strawberries, citrus, oats, and yeast. The tree nuts I take a little exception to, and I want you to have your ears open to this. People will say, nope, I'm allergic to tree nuts. Well, generally when you're allergic to food, you're allergic to a particular family of foods, right? So you may say, I'm sensitive to the cruciferous vegetables. And then we know we're not going to give you any foods that are in that family. But tree nuts are not one family. They're actually quite a number of families. So a lot of people who are told that they're sensitive to tree nuts are actually sensitive to some tree nuts, a few. Very few are sensitive to all. So all as part of the elimination, though, you eliminate them. If they've been told they have a tree nut allergy, you're going to eliminate them. You're going to eliminate all the gluten, all the dairy, all the soy, all the corn, all the peanuts for whatever the predetermined amount of time you decide is. You also, if they've ever had a problem with reaction to shellfish or been told they had a problem or tree nuts or strawberries or citrus or oats or yeast, you're going to remove those as well. Okay, if you want to remove all of them during the elimination period, I'll share with you some protocols for doing that. You can certainly do that as well. And anything they suspect, you know, I always notice that whenever I eat eggplant, my tongue tingles. Okay, let's put an eggplant on this elimination. And there could be a lot more on it, and I'll show you how to design an elimination diet. So the process we use is called the elimination and the provocation process, right? Elimination is obvious, you get rid of it. A provocation means, you know, what do? You provoke something, you provoke it. You're going to provoke the system to see if it responds. Generally speaking, if a person is off of something that they are sensitive to for long enough and then they introduce it back, the experience is going to be magnified. The symptoms are going to be magnified. So we'll really, really get a sense of it, right? I was talking to someone the other day who said basically she'd been off of all this stuff for a while. She'd done a long cleanse and then she gave in to some of her food indulgences, and she had, you know, gluten and dairy, and she didn't immediately feel bad. Nothing happened to her gut. But she said over the next few days, she just has started to get unfocused and depressed and anxious. And she said, why is that happening? I said, because of those foods. Well, those foods never caused that before. Well, yeah, they did. But it was just a big, like, adding on to the bucket that was already really, really full. And it wasn't making that much of a difference. So what we do is we eliminate the suspects for at least 4 days. And quite frankly, I used to do 4 days in the olden days. Now I'm more likely to do 3 weeks or longer, just because you get a better sense. It's really a matter of how well somebody's willing to go through this and how strict they are during the elimination process and how much better they get. Like oftentimes you do an elimination for as long as it takes, could be the answer, as long as it takes. So if you put somebody on an elimination and they're gradually getting better and they're gradually getting better, but they're still not 100%, don't you want to continue it until they are at 100% or as close as you can get them till they plateau? So that's one thing. And then the other thing is if you put them on an elimination diet and you do it for 4 days to a week and they don't get any better at all, or in fact they get worse, then it's probably not those foods, or it's partially those foods, but it's not enough and you need to get the rest of them. So there's a number of ways to do an elimination diet. One is to just eliminate everything, water fast. That was my very first elimination diet, was a 5-day water fast. Another way is to give them a hypoallergenic medical food or elemental diet kind of a mixture. It's usually a pretty sterile mixture, lots of just synthetic vitamins and minerals with some sort of a protein source that you're unlikely that they're going to be sensitive to. Although sometimes you put them on and they get worse. It's like, okay, maybe this food, this protein powder drink is not working. There's a number of them out there. I don't recommend the commercial ones like Ensure and all that, but things like Ultra Clear Sustain, MediClear Pro, there's a bunch of stuff like that, or just making it up yourself, helping them with the design of that themselves. Another way to do it is a juice fast. In doing this, you do have to be careful that the juice you choose to have them juice on is not something they're already sensitive to. But when I say fast, it's in parentheses here because I don't believe anything is fast unless it's completely eliminated. So a water fast is more of a fast, and this is like a colloquially a fast. So maybe they just drink celery, cucumber, kale juice for days, and they know they've never had a sensitivity to that, and they could get really well, much better that way. But the other one is called the rare foods diet, and you don't hear that talked about very much. Dr. Elton Haas does talk about that in Falstaff Diet. He talks about the rare foods diet and the rare foods elimination diet. And basically, the gist of this is that what you're going to do is you're going to only put them on foods that they hardly ever eat. The idea being, if they have this ongoing set of symptoms, they're not going to be eating this other food. It's unlikely to be the contributing factor. So you take them off of everything that they normally eat and you put them on a rare foods diet. And I'm going to share with you some of the tools and the forms I use to help people design a rare foods diet. And I'm also going to have this up. It's up on the page for you and it'll be on the done for you page so you can use these forms with your clients. So what do you do for provocation? Well, it's really super important that you only do one new food at a time. Well, some people you can get away with a food group. Say it's broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage are the ones they eat the most, and that's in the cruciferous family. You can introduce all three of those in large amounts for 3 days. And I call it the 3-day rule because it's you're testing them for 3 days. Maybe you have a little bit the first day, more the second day, a lot on the third day, but you want to make sure you're flooding your system with this food, or they are. And then you can tell if it's actually having a response. You don't want them to overeat it, however, because that can create problems and symptoms in and of itself. You don't want them to say, okay, I'm testing rice today, and they sit down and they eat 2 pounds of rice. That would make anybody not feel well. That's what I did after my first 5-day allergy elimination fast. It wasn't fun. And I was like, I was feeling miserable and I can really continue it. So the 3-day rule, they take it for 3 days. If they get a bad reaction on the first day, but they're not really sure it's that food, then they continue to eat that food. And when they're, once it's clear, you have them off of that food completely. And I'll show you the charts I use to monitor it. So if they don't have a reaction the first day, and they don't have a reaction the second day, and they don't have a reaction the third day, and they're feeling really good, it hasn't made a change, then that food gets to go in their yes column. And I'll show you how. Very, very careful. So let's talk a little bit about the types of allergy responses in food allergies. And then we're going to, this is just a review, and then we're going to go into a little bit more. So it's immediate or delayed sensitivity. I said that before. IgE is usually the immediate, and IgG is usually the delayed. You will see IgMs in an early stage of an allergic response, and IgA if the in areas where there's mucous membrane. So, for example, I'll give you an example. EnteroLab runs a food sensitivity panel. They started out with just gluten. Now they do food sensitivity, maybe a couple of dozen foods, and they do it through a stool test. What they're measuring is the IgA in the gut. And here's the thing. The idea is that with the IgG, it's delayed. It's also not going to last as long. So the IgGs, they elevate while there's a problem. They stay elevated for a while, and then they go down. So if you try to test somebody in their blood with an IgG response, what's going to happen is that they're going to get a false negative most of the time, because they haven't been exposed to that food for a long time. With the IgAs, I think of them as the soldiers in waiting. They're just sitting there, and they're waiting for something to come, and waiting for something to come, and waiting for something to come. And then when you something comes in, like a gluten or a dairy or an egg or a peanut or whatever, it attacks. So I personally like the IgA testing, although it's inconvenient to have to test the stool. You can test IgA in the blood as well. There are some food sensitivity panels that allow you to test all of these, but they're pricey, and I haven't gotten any clients yet to be able to bite it, to want to bite it at $1,300 a pop. Okay, we talked about the difference between food allergies and food sensitivities. With a food sensitivity or a food intolerance, you are not going to get immunology involved. So if you want to call it an allergy, you need to know that there are antibodies, right? Otherwise, just be safe, call it sensitivities. Because we're under the radar a lot with medical doctors who think that any of this stuff is quackery, and they'll use anything to cut us down. So if you're speaking and you say, well, this food allergy, how do you know they had a food allergy? Well, it's because this reaction. That's not a food allergy. So speak in the right terms. But if you've done a test and you've seen antibodies, then you can certainly say they have a food allergy. Make sense? And again, I can't emphasize this enough. I can't emphasize enough that you've got to get the gut clean. Got to. Okay. So I like to start with finding out what they eat frequently, because that gives me the suspicious foods, and that helps me to design a rare foods diet. Now, this form is on the page with this video recording. So it's Dr. Amiricom Go Food Frequency Checklist. And when you go to that list, you're going to see something that just basically asks them through a series of drop-down questions, how often do they eat these particular foods? Now, I have it in a fancy form. You could do it on paper and pen. You can pick the foods that you're most interested in looking at. I have a lot of exotic foods in here, but there's a lot of foods. All the categories of foods are included in this test, and they just go through and rate how frequently they do it. And I'll share with you my process for teaching them what to eat from that. So in terms of identifying their trigger foods, I call it the no-go-maybe protocol. And I've got a handout for you to go through this. So you want to be able to find out which are the go foods, which are the no foods, and which are the slow foods or the maybe foods. And what you do is you have them do that food frequency assessment, and then you have them highlight the no foods. What are the no foods? Well, the no foods are known or suspected allergens. We highlight those in red. What else? Well, foods that they eat on a regular basis, foods that they crave, foods that they, once they start eating, they can't live without, foods they tend to overeat, and foods they notice that they get symptoms after they do it, okay? So the next thing that you're going to do is create a grid of those foods. So you identify the no foods, then you go and identify the slow foods, and then the go. Well, I usually do the no foods first, the go foods next, and then the maybe foods after that. So we're trying to get an elimination diet for them that's not just the same four foods every day, especially if you have to do a longer elimination period for them. So I want to get them to be able to eat foods in the variety of categories. And this is a chart that you've got access to, and you can actually look at this stuff and say, okay, what can I get them in this category? What can I get them in this category? What in this category? So any of the foods that they never or hardly ever eat are good candidates for the go. And you would kind of lay them out on this grid, try to get them spread out if you're doing a four-day elimination so that you're not repeating it, so they're not getting the same stuff every day. But you're basically picking one or two foods in each of these categories to consume every day. And they need to be the ones that they've never had an allergic reaction to, they don't eat a lot of, they eat it rarely, and that's the way you do it. Okay, this sounds like it's a little bit complicated, and it is a little complicated, but it's worth it as opposed to they just say, well, I'm just going to get rid of these 10 foods for the next few days, and that's my elimination diet, because they could be inadvertently eating something that they usually eat every day, that they love, that they don't want to give up, and that's really a problematic food for them. So it's really, really simple, actually, when you get the hang of it. I have them track their symptoms. You can use any symptom tracking form that you want. You've got those in our history taking module. And then we go and look at their food reintroduction guidelines. So you leave them off of the foods. How do you know when to get them started on provocation? Well, you're basically judging it by how they react during the elimination. Do they feel great? Do they feel like, wow, I'm better than I felt in a really long time? Great. You can start reintroducing, because you want them to be able to tell when they introduce these foods if there's a subtle change or a not so subtle change. So we have this laid out. The stuff that's in the go column gets to be their foods that they have consumed less than once a month usually. You can also use the ones that they've consumed between once a week and once a month if you don't have enough in the rare foods. And then you would go to the foods consumed 1 to 3 times a week, which is the moderate frequency. Those are the ones that you would do next. So if you're eliminating, you want to be able to eliminate all but the rare foods, if possible. If not, you're going to be able to try some of the infrequent ones. So it's all those foods that they rarely eat, infrequently eat, moderately eat, and then the stuff that they have in terms of supplements they're taking that they know are good. It's great if you can get people off supplements during an elimination diet. It's not always possible because they've been prescribed these supplements by other practitioners, and you don't want to get in the middle of that. Okay, so you've decided what you're going to reintroduce. I want you to start with the goes, right? Because these are the foods that are most likely, if you've eliminated during the period, say you've fasted or juiced or just had a really rare foods diet, you're unlikely to have a reaction. The next ones you would add would be the infrequent foods. The next one would be the moderate frequency foods, and then the well-tolerated. I like to kind of phase them in that way. Once they've added back in all the go foods, as many of those as they choose, and they want to start going further, they can look at the slow foods. Go really, really slow with these. Be careful when you're adding them, okay? List foods that you consume 4 to 6 times a week there, okay? That's the frequent foods. The daily foods are foods that you can consume daily or multiple times of the day. Less likely that we're going to add those right away. So we're going slowly. We're going to add these things in a very, very strategic way. And then if there are any suspects that were noted during the elimination phase, so during the elimination phase, you should be down to everything that's cool, but you start to notice that, every time I eat potatoes, tomatoes, broccoli, I get this particular symptom. That would be put in the suspect foods. And then the supplements, any supplements you stopped during the elimination diet, you can start to put in here. So we're basically creating a chart. You're going to be creating a chart that you can use to help them to put together a very strategic reintroduction. Okay. And we have the no. These are foods we're going to get rid of. And in the sample chart that I have for you, I actually listed all of the top allergens and the foods that I think people should stay away from probably for a really long time. Any digestive irritants, you've got a foods that hurt your gut page and the digestive modules, you want to list those there. So you're basically asking them to fill out this form and list these foods based on what they filled out first, which was the food frequency. The known and suspected problematic foods, and then the foods that a person deliberately avoids. That's a good thing to get from people because you may find that for religious or social or cultural or taste preference reasons, there's a bunch of stuff they don't and won't eat. So you don't want that to be on their plan. Okay. Now, the next set of guidelines. This is just further down there. There's no more on the go side, but there's other things you're going to list. So it's a one-page document. You get the person or you list it for them to list all these foods, and then you help them with the phasing in, like which foods first, negotiate flavors, because a lot of times people want things back quickly, and make a plan for the reintroduction. This is a blank food reintroduction guide, although it's not really blank because I put in some of the foods that I think everybody should definitely stay away from during this process. And then there's a suspicious food tracking list. So now you've got them designed this amazing elimination diet. You've got them introducing foods. And now we have to track. We have to be super, super diligent and careful when we have them add it back. Remember, we're doing one food every 3 days or one group of foods every 3 days. And I recommend that you start with some of the stuff that you are less likely to find that hurts them. Mainly because on an elimination diet, they're down to very few foods and we want to be able to expand that repertoire pretty quickly. If you decide after 3 week elimination that you want them to test gluten or dairy or something you know they've been allergic to in the past, and they have a bad reaction, it's going to set their testing back. And with gluten, it might set their testing back a long time. So I usually start with the foods that are least suspicious. I start with the foods in the go column and just start adding them. So I build them back a decent repertoire of food so that if this process goes on for several months, that they can handle it because they've still got a lot of variety in what they're eating. So they're going to make this chart for you, and I've given you a blank. The first column is foods that make me feel great. Like you eat it, you feel great, no worries. Those are the foods that are, you know, the equivalent of the go foods. The foods they're suspicious about. So they've just done this elimination. They're feeling good. They add back some foods. Maybe they weren't careful and had some new foods on a salad or in a mixed vegetable dish or in some sort of casserole, and it was heavy, it was a lot of food, and they got a reaction. So they don't know if it was that food that they added back or if it was indeed something related to the heaviness of the meal or the stress under which they ate. So it's a suspicious food. It only gets to go to the go food if they make it through 3 days and they feel great the whole 3 days. Or they feel better, good. And then the foods that cause problems. Those are the ones we know. You eat it, you have a reaction. You eat it, you have a reaction. So those would go there. So you're having them really monitor throughout their process to see how things are affecting them. Conscious eating at its best. Again, use the symptom tracking form, whatever one you use, because you want to keep track of their symptoms. So I have this thing has a little column. The lines aren't showing up real well on the slide, but there's actually columns when you get this one in print or in an Excel sheet. And if you wanted to use mine, you're welcome to it. But you want to keep track of all the things that I have on here to see if that food is affecting them. So blood sugar would be nice as well. You're looking at their pulse before, their pulse after, their stress level, their level of cravings, any symptoms in the gut, any stomach pain, headaches, low energy, lots of that stuff. You can put all of that on this chart. So the foods would be listed and then the symptoms would be listed. So what do you do with them after they do the elimination diet? Okay. In order to do this provocation properly and get good results, you need to start and create a plan to get and keep their digestive and immune system strong and happy. Absolutely must, or they're going to be back in that same situation as soon as you let go of their hand. Finding suitable substitutes for the eliminated foods is really a good thing to do, especially if somebody's off them long term. So if somebody's used to eating ice cream and they just, you know they can't eat ice cream, maybe you can find a coconut cream substitute, frozen dessert type thing to help them with that. If you're taking them off of green leafy vegetables, for example, find other green leafy vegetables that you can substitute in. Really important. Create a diet plan that leads to being happy and well-nourished. What does that mean? Well, too many times I see people just blowing it, just going crazy with food restriction, paranoia about everything. And it causes a lot of stress. And that stress probably hurts them more than the foods that they're worried about. So helping the people create a plan that makes them joyful. If they don't like to be in the kitchen, they're not in the kitchen much. If they love to be in the kitchen, then you give them strategies and new recipes and things like that. Okay, but this is super critical to any success with this process. And then assess and test for underlying imbalances. If they're not really, really better after that, there may be some other imbalances that are holding them back. Okay, so here's some foods and habits to increase list. So you would basically have them go, okay, what do we want to get more of? If you want them to get more green leafy vegetables, if you want them to eat more carrots, if you want them to eat, have more peppermint tea, this is where you would put it. Really just a plain chart. It's not moving forward. Okay, there we go. So substitutes, did I get it right? Yeah. Oh, supplements and herbs to add. There we go. If they have specific stuff they're on, make a list. There's a checklist for you, a place you can put it. If they, you need them to add new stuff, make a list and phase them in just like you do the foods. A lot of practitioners make the mistake of giving somebody a long laundry list of supplements, even if it's 4 or 5 supplements. And then just having them try it. And then if they have a reaction, not good. So if they've done this elimination diet, they're clean slate. This is the time to test things one at a time. So we need substitutes for their favorites. Don't forget that eating has become a joy for people. Eating has become an outlet. It's a social thing. It's a cultural thing. And when they've got particular trigger foods, they can be devastated by not being able to fix this. Well, you can do a substitute, and we have a swap chart that we're going to put on that page that basically is, here's some of the foods they're trying to avoid. What's the good, better, best approach to substituting out? Because you can't just tell people you can't eat this ever again. First of all, if you're pulling out foods after provocation, you're continuing to work on their gut. And someday, hopefully, they'll add them back, although there are some permanent allergies. So what are the trigger foods, and what are some of the substitutes that you can give them for that? Brainstorm with them. Just pull out a plain blank sheet of paper, put these columns on it, and say, let's figure it out. Here's the trigger foods that are causing you to either have an allergic reaction or go into compulsive overeating, because those are all the kinds of signs you're looking for. You're not just looking for histamines. You're not just looking for rashes or diarrhea or bloating or any of that. You're looking for that whole physiology. So what happens when they eat that food? Do they get lethargic? Do they lose pleasure? Do they feel lightheaded? Do they have brain fog? There's so many things, and those trigger foods need to be taken out. But the other one is, do they crave? Once they eat a bite of something, do they just obsess and want to eat more? That's a sign that it's a trigger food. So help them create the happy diet, my happy diet, foods I love, foods that love me. What does that mean? Well, foods I love might include ice cream and bread and pasta and crackers and cookies. Foods that love me are the foods that I eat and I feel great with. and really helping people to move away from the damaging foods they love and create the foods that love me diet, right? And let's talk about some special considerations for gluten. So we've talked about how to do this. We've talked about how to create an elimination diet for somebody, when you would want to create an elimination diet. Some of the, let's just say, clinical downsides of it being that the people get too picky and too crazy and they're limited to so little food, and that you have to include the immune support and the digestive support in order for them to ever be able to go back on these foods. And we talked about doing anywhere from a 3-4 day to a 3-month elimination. But with gluten, there's some special situations here. Because it's been shown that the damage from gluten in the body, in the gut, in the immune system, in creating autoimmunity, has such a long-lasting effect, up to 6 months and sometimes even a year, I believe it's super important for anybody with symptoms that they're going to be coming to you with, the low energy, the fatigue, the muscle aches, the joint pains, the digestive issues, the hormone imbalances, that you get them off of gluten for 6 months. Now, some of them are going to scream and yell, and we're going to talk about some testing that you can do to prove to them that they have to or don't. But I find that everybody benefits, and then after 6 months, if they've tested clean, then you can go back. And the testing should happen at the beginning. So before you take them off gluten, ideally you test them, because some of the tests won't show up, and I'll show you which ones those are. But if you have to do it just at the end, then, you know, you can have them say, look, I really want to go back to gluten. I want to go back to gluten. Okay, you can go back to gluten. Here's what you have to do. You have to eat it several times a day for 3 days, and then at least once a week for the next month. And then if you feel lousy and you're convinced, we'll take you off of it. But if you don't feel lousy and you're not convinced, then after that exposure, we're going to do some testing. Okay? And if they can maintain their health and they have no allergic reactions to it, they can go back on it. I don't recommend that they go back on it regularly. And for most people, this doesn't work. Let's just say that you've got somebody who you've taken off of gluten and they've agreed to go the full 6 months, but they are chomping at the bit wanting to get back on their gluten. They have been complaining the whole time. They're feeling better. A lot of their symptoms are resolved. So here's my criteria for allowing them to try it again. My criteria is that, number one, they're feeling really, really good. Most, if not all, of the symptoms that they came, actually, I in my opinion, all of the symptoms that they came to see you for are gone. They're feeling full of energy. They've got lots of energy. They've got really good muscle tone. They don't have pain. They don't have inflammation. Their gut's working well. They're feeling great. If they're not at that point, you say, okay, let's wait until you are. Because you don't want to disrupt the good stuff that you did by throwing gluten back in the mix if they're not all the way back and you can't really tell very well, unless they have a really good baseline to compare it to. Right? If they're still feeling kind of achy, better than they were, but not quite, and it's not really quantifiable, it's going to be harder for when they go back. So if all the criteria is good and you decide, it's time for them to try it, they're really insistent on it, then number one, you get them to go ahead and keep a really careful diary and you get them to add it back on a regular basis. So every day for the first few days, like every day, and they're really carefully monitoring their symptoms. If anything gets worse, then they're off of it again, right? And they go off of it again for a long period of time because they're not ready to go off of it. If they still feel okay, then you just have them add it every day for the rest of that month. So for a whole month, they're eating gluten every day. Then you can go ahead and order one of these tests that we're going to talk about in a little while. Okay? If that's the case, then they're going to need to have it in their system. The EnteroLab test, of course, you can do at any time and it'll show antibodies. So if they're willing to do the poop test, you have them do the poop test. If any antibodies show in the poop test, then they're off of it. So those are two different approaches. One is if they're like, oh, I don't want to do the poop test. I'm not doing a poop test. I don't think they're accurate. I want to go to the blood. Then there are some good blood tests, but you have to have a person eating the gluten for an extended period of time before they take the test. Otherwise, it's going to show a false negative. With the stool test, because remember I said they're like the soldiers in waiting. They're just waiting and waiting. And as soon as something comes in, they activate. So they will still be there and they'll be measurable in the stool. They'll be lower than they were probably at the start, but they don't really go away if there's a long-standing issue with the gluten, right? If there's a genetic tendency or a lot of damage has been done or whatever. So those are the situations with gluten. So let's talk a little bit more about working with somebody with getting them off of gluten. So most of this is a review, but I feel it inclined to do a review. What we're going to talk about in this section is what gluten is, where it's found, what gluten intolerance is, and how it can silently destroy health, the difference between celiac and non-celiac gluten intolerance, how to recognize symptoms, how to test for gluten intolerance, and how to manage them, the patients with gluten intolerance. So gluten is really a protein, or actually a group of proteins. It's gliadin, it's glutenin, and gluten itself is gliadin plus glutenin. And there's alpha gliadin, beta gliadin, etc. So there's multiple versions of these. Very few tests for all of them. When we talk about the testing in a little bit, we'll see that there is one lab that tests the full spectrum. Most of them just test alpha gliadin. And if that doesn't show up, they assume people are fine. So within the types of proteins, we have albumins, which are soluble in water, globulins, which is an example of avenolin of oat, and then things called prolamines. The gliadin in wheat is a kind of prolamine. Also, others that are very similar to the gliadin in wheat, which can cause a cross-reactivity, are the zein in corn, the avenin of oats, hortulin in barley, sacculin in rye, and kaffirin in sorghum. So these are all not just necessarily safe foods for people to eat if you're taking them off of gluten. And then there's the glutenolins, or the glutenins, they're called in wheat. Okay? And you'll hear something called the wheat germ agglutinin. Okay? It's not gliadin, but a person can have a reaction to the glutenin as well. This is what gliadin looks like structurally. There's alpha gliadin, there's beta gliadin, there's gamma gliadin, and there's omega gliadins. So when you go to the doctor and they test for, somebody comes in and says, I'm not gluten intolerant, my doctor tested me. Turns out they tested them for alpha gliadin in their blood, IgG usually for alpha gliadin. And then what they did was maybe a biopsy, or they test for transglutaminase, which means that there's already been some damage done to the gut and there's some antibodies to that. They don't test the full spectrum. You might catch 80% of them with testing alpha gliadin. But if your client is in that 20% that's unsuspectingly continuing to eat the gluten, they're going to have a problem. Where is it found? Wheat, barley, rye, triticale, spelt, and kamut. But remember that some of these other grains can cross-react because they have similar types of proteins, right? The zein in the corn and the avenin in oats, remember those. These are some of the gluten-containing foods, you know, and you guys know this, but this is a good chart for you to be able to share or something like it with your clients. They don't know. I've had so many people say, well, I eat Ezekiel bread. I don't eat gluten. I'm gluten-free. I only eat Ezekiel bread. Ezekiel bread is sprouted gluten, right? So they need to be educated. I have a document that I give people when they go on my site and they register for a gluten-free handout. They get this thing. It's a little magazine type thing. And I have this like 3 or 4 pages of the hidden sources of gluten. And we'll make sure that that's up on the page. I believe that we did put that in another part of the program, but we'll make sure that it's up on the page. All right, so these are all the foods, the breads, the tortillas, all the grainy stuff, the sauces, the cereals, the ketchup, tomato sauce sometimes, soups, vinegars, beers, everything that is suspicious they need to avoid. So what are some of the symptoms of gluten intolerance? Well, you know, it's variable, right? People think, I don't get diarrhea when I eat bread. I don't have a problem. How many times have you had your clients say that to you? Oh, but I don't have a problem with gluten. Well, what do you mean I don't have a problem with gluten? Well, I eat it. I get fine. I don't have to go to the bathroom. I don't get diarrhea. I don't get bloated. I'm fine. Well, that's just part of it. They may have weight loss. They may have weight gain. They may have nutritional deficiencies. Like they've been told they're anemic and they can't get their anemia up. Why? Because they're eating gluten and it affects the absorption of those nutrients. They may have gastrointestinal problems, but those aren't the ones that say, oh, it's not a problem. But they may have fat in their stools because of poor digestion, because gluten's disrupting this. So there's nothing that's off limits when it comes to this. So they also can have aching joints, depression, anxiety, eczema, that chicken skin, you know, headaches, exhaustion, and brain fog. They don't associate this with gluten. But I've had people who have taken them off of gluten and they thought that they were not sensitive and then they've gone back on it, didn't wait the 6 months like I recommended, waited just 2-3 weeks, and the brain fog and the depression came back big time. Sometimes they don't notice that something gets bad or better when you take them off of something. I had that situation. I didn't realize that some of the symptoms I was having, like this, you know, kind of headachey almost feeling that I was having on a regular basis until it went away and then it came back. I didn't even notice when it went away because it was so subtle. And then when it came back, I'm like, whoa, I used to feel like this every day, right? And sometimes people don't associate that they have brain fog until the fog lifts and then they feel better. Infertility, irregular menstrual cycle, and miscarriage. This is a very common one. Dr. Tom O'Brien talks about this from his personal situation, where he had friends and family members who had approached him about infertility, and he took them off of gluten, and they got pregnant, right? He started working with a lot of people after that. Cramps, tingling, numbness, neurological symptoms. Slow infant and child growth. No, that little kid that's just not coming up to the growth chart. And decline in dental health. And how many times do you see that? You see little kids going in and having their teeth filled when they're 8 and 10 years old. That shouldn't be happening. These are all signs that there could be a gluten problem. Others, irritability, behavior changes, early onset Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, autism and ADD. People don't associate those tremors. They don't associate the dementia, the memory loss with gluten. And that's another sign. Back in the 1930s, there was a scientist, I don't recall his name exactly, but he did one of the first studies that associated gluten with neurological imbalance. He started seeing the connection back in the 1930s, right? Up until then, we heard of celiac disease, and it was only this very rare condition where people had their gut ripped up because they ate gluten. Very common, the neurologic. I did a whole paper for one of my theses on the neurodevelopmental effects of gluten. And I learned a ton of stuff about how it affects the brain. Hugely important. So if you're dealing with anybody with the depression, the anxiety, mental fatigue, any kind of mental or neurologic disorders, you've got to think gluten. Also, thyroid problems. And gluten interacts with the thyroid in that it cross-reacts with it. It causes the antibodies cross-react with it in that it can cause the breakdown of the thyroid. It can cause autoimmunity. So if anybody wants to work with me and they have autoimmunity or they have thyroid issues, I won't work with them unless they're willing to go off the gluten. I won't work with them. I'm not going to look for, well, I don't want to go off the gluten. What else can I do? How many times have you been asked that? I don't want to take it off sugar, but what else can I do to balance my insulin? Nothing. Nothing, right? And I really feel like you need to be strong with them and provide them with evidence. Let them know. These food sensitivities create autoimmune disease if it's left unchecked. That's serious. And they're told that it's a life sentence, and it's not. It can create insulin resistance. It can damage the insulin receptors, lead to diabetes, definitely the autoimmunes, Crohn's, which is an autoimmune disease, but of the gut, very serious. Very doubling over in pain and bleeding out of the rectum. No fun. And all sorts of hormone imbalances. Female hormones, male hormones, adrenal hormones, thyroid hormones. All of this can be the result of gluten. So I want you to really take this seriously. And when you bring cases to the community, it's like, don't expect that we can give you major solutions because the person doesn't want to go off gluten. It's the first thing to ask when you have a mom presenting with a child with hypothyroidism. What are they eating? It's the first thing to ask when you have a mom presenting with a child with ADD. When you have somebody presenting with depression and anxiety, brain fog, and they've tried a lot of things. They're on a supplement list that's as long as your arm, but they're not getting better. Could be gluten or another one of the food allergies, which goes back to this whole topic of elimination diet. Super important. Okay, so alternatives to elimination diets. I said alternatives, and then I have second thoughts about alternatives. Options to you can use in addition to or instead of elimination diets, because seriously, you've got to get them off the foods. But when I say this, what I mean is the whole elimination provocation. Sometimes it's bloody confusing and they don't get easy answers. I usually start there, but sometimes it's like, okay, let's look to see what we can do for testing, because there are ways to do it. Now, the tests are not that accurate either. 80%-ish is what I've heard, researched, read over the years. They may be a little bit better now with some of the more advanced testing, like the ones that Cyrex does. But still, they obviously have to eliminate the foods. But it's when they've tried it, they've done the elimination, they've eliminated all the major stuff there. It's really, it's curious. Maybe it's something really obvious that they're eating every day, but we're not thinking is obvious. That's when you do the allergy testing, in my opinion. Some people do it right from the start, but this is my opinion. But, and also if you've got somebody who's really skeptical about the leaky gut, skeptical about food allergies, because the truth of the matter is when you run these tests on people who are sick, you are going to get results. Are they meaningful results? The jury's out. Are you going to be able to pinpoint the exact foods? The jury's out. But what happens is with someone with leaky gut, when those tests come back, there are tons of allergies. There's not one or two and you go, oh, we found it, we're just going to get rid of it. No, there's usually 25. And when mom comes in with little Johnny, who's having trouble at school, and now on top of her trouble, you're going to add that he has to avoid these 25 foods, which 20 of them just happen to be his favorites, that he can't live without. It's tough. And you've got to be working the leaky gut. So I'm a big fan of getting the leaky gut protocols in place, working with the gut before doing these tests, eliminating the obvious, eliminating the big six, eliminating the suspects, doing a rare foods diet if you can get them to do it. But elimination before you do this. And that's why I said it's not necessarily an alternative to elimination. It's something you do with in conjunction to it. So there's some blood antibody food tests. There's a lot of them. The 100-panel food test for $99. There's others that are 100-panel food tests for $6.99. How do you discern? How do you know? Well, generally speaking, when you get these blood tests from, you know, the various labs that do them, they're going to offer you and measure the antibody titers to a specific number of foods, 10 foods, 20 foods, 100 foods, the vegetarian panel, the spice panel. And usually what they're measuring are IgG. Sometimes they'll measure IgG or IgE. My personal feeling about IgE being measured is that it's pretty close to useless, because those are the ones you can usually tell. Eat a food, get a reaction. Eat a food, get a reaction, right? You can simply do, you know, a few days of just eating your foods one at a time, spacing them out a couple of hours apart, and figure out what the IgGs are going to be. The IgGs are tough because they can come on subtly and slowly. And they eat the food, and then 3 hours later, they eat another food. And then they get the reaction. And they blame the food at the meal they just ate. Have you ever had that happen? Oh yeah, I just had broccoli for that meal. Why did I get reaction? Well, you had spelt at lunch, or you had, brown rice, or you had some sort of spice that you have an allergy to. So it's really tough. This whole situation of elimination provocation is not simple, but it's profoundly effective. So it's worth the effort. Some labs offer IgM and IgG, IgA, along with the IgG and or IgE. And that's really good because you get to see if there's some early stuff. You get to see if there's mucous membrane. Mixed reliability and tons of positives with leaky gut, as I said. So let's talk about a few of them. The ALCAT, food intolerance test, they don't measure IgGs and IgAs. They measure the response to the leukocytes. Leukocytes are white blood cells. They call it an antigen leukocyte antibody test. So they identify cellular reactions. They're actually looking at it under a microscope to see what happens in the white blood cells when you eat these foods. But the thing is, it can change from day to day. They're not necessarily permanent responses, and they definitely change with leaky gut. I've worked with this. I've had people who've wanted to do it after we couldn't figure out, you know, from elimination, or they didn't want to continue the elimination, and they get it done, and there's a ton of foods, and they give you a report, and it shows yellows, greens, blues, reds, as far as severity, and they'll come back with, you know, minimum 20-25 is what I've seen. And now they're supposed to stay away from the red ones for 6 months and the yellow ones for 3 months and the blue ones for a month and the green ones they could eat. And you get them to do it. And when you retest, guess what? It's completely different. Completely different. So is it good to get as a guideline? Sure. Is it scary, though? Because if the things you suspect don't show up that particular day in that one, then they're going, oh, I can eat gluten. I can eat cheese. I can eat these things. And then they can be going downhill. So it's all, you know, this whole area of food allergy testing is one that just, it drives us up the wall. There's the Interalab stool antibody test. They haven't been getting a lot of write-up, a lot of press. You don't see a lot of people talking about them. But what I've seen is that even if the person's been away from those foods, it'll measure the antibodies. So I find that they're more accurate than most. So if somebody really wants to do it, I usually have them do this. If they want to test for gluten, they can measure for $99. They can get just the gluten, the anti-gliadin. It's just alpha-gliadin. So it's going to miss if the person has in beta or any of the other gliadins, or it's a glutenin problem. But they can do it. There's cross-reactive stool antigens, so they do that, things that are going to cross-react. There's the IgAs. They measure, not Gs, not Es, because they're measuring what's lining the gut. You can also get an expanded test where they look at inflammatory markers and genetics, and they test a couple of dozen other allergens besides gluten. So the cross-reactive one is the basic ones, the gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, peanuts, or something like that. And then the full panel is a couple of dozen. Okay? That's one that's a possibility, and they can order it themselves. You don't have to order it for them. It's direct to consumer. The gluten subfractions reactivity from Cyrex. Okay? Cyrex does Array 3. It's a blood test and assesses the gluten reactivity in 12 different fractions, not just gliadin. And it's pretty sensitive. They do measure IgAs and Gs, so it's not just the Gs. And, you know, you can get a fairly good response to it. Again, you have to have the person eat this stuff consistently for a month, or you won't get it. So if you've got somebody who's been off of gluten and they're getting better, you run the risk of them getting worse because they have to eat all this junk. It's kind of hard to do. So that's why I say if you're going to do these tests, you do it before they go off the gluten, before they go off the foods, because that's going to give you the most accurate response. And then you can do it again after they've done the leaky gut repair and gotten off the foods and done their provocation. Then you can go back and do it again to see how it shows up. I think that's the best way to use these tests. Cyrex also has a cross-reactivity, where that's antibody array 4. Again, they're measuring IgGs and IgAs, and they're measuring them to these particular things that are known cross-reactives. So sometimes I have people who want every test in the book, and then I have people who don't want any tests. So what I'll do is I'll give them this list of foods, this cross-reactive list, food list, and they'll say, I'll just avoid those for a few months, and then I'll add them back. And that's really been helpful as well. Okay? This shows equivocal and out of range. To me, anything that's not normal is a problem. So people say, well, it's not really, it's equivocal. It means you're having a reaction to it. Dump it. Okay? And this is a question that comes up a lot when I'm working with people. Well, why should I do a gluten cross-reactivity? Well, 30% of gluten-sensitive people don't get the results when you just take them off gluten. And they go, oh, I'm not sensitive to gluten. It mustn't be gluten. In reality, it's the cross-reactives. And it's some of the foods they've added to replace the gluten. You know, those gluten-free bagels and cookies and all the goodies? They tend to react to those. So it measures the foods that are known to cross-react with gluten or to coexist with gluten sensitivity. And a large percentage of people sensitive to gluten are sensitive to casein, the milk protein. I've seen it to be as much as 80 to 90%, 90% and over in some reports. So there's a lot of people out there who are promoting gluten-free. We have all these gluten-free products and they still have eggs and milk in them. Eggs and milk will cross-react. So if you want to truly get on a gluten-free product that's going to be quote-unquote safe, it needs to be free of casein and eggs and I think some of the top allergens, but certainly that. And that's what you see in a lot of the products. I look and go, oh, look at that, gluten-free muffins. Yeah, it's made with white rice flour, lots of sugar, lots of eggs, and some dairy. It's not exactly a health food either. That's another whole story. So managing food intolerance. If you suspect food intolerance, which you should suspect food intolerance as an underlying theme with any of your people coming in. But if you're doing all this work with people, you're working on their gut, you're getting their blood sugar balanced, you're getting them doing the foundational approaches, they've cleaned out all the junk, they're doing a lot of good things, and they're still having symptoms, it's time to start looking for those specific food intolerances that may have been missed in the general overall good protocol. So you run through, you do the elimination diet, or you run a test at this point. You find out the additional foods that they're sensitive to. You get them off, and you work on the leaky gut. If you'd been working on the leaky gut, but they're still having issues, you can test for leaky gut. More details of that are in our GI testing module. But the testing for leaky gut is something that you can do. And Cyrex Labs, again, does Array 2, which is the intestinal permeability test. And what they're testing for is a breakdown of the intestinal wall, those particular proteins that are found in the intestinal wall or the proteins produced by the bacteria are getting into the bloodstream and creating an immune reaction. So it tests for actinomycin. It tests for lipopolysaccharides. And they'll give you a report based on that and gives you an idea of whether they have the leaky gut. If that's the case and they've got a leaky gut, in spite of you doing the leaky gut repair protocol and working on the food and getting rid of the food and they're not secretly closet eating the junk food, then it may be time to do a stool test to see if there's particular bugs that are not saying bye-bye yet or particular flora imbalances that are not saying bye-bye yet, and you want to look at that. So really a matter of working the whole person, doing the foundational things first, going deeper with the elimination diets, going deeper with the food allergy testing, but meanwhile, all the while working on that gut, making sure they're chewing their food, making sure they're eating in a parasympathetic dominant state, making sure that they're producing enough stomach acid, enough digestive enzymes, supporting them along the way, making sure their microbiome is in balance, getting rid of the undesirables and enhancing the desirables. All of these things are going to go a long way in managing food intolerance, which, after all, is the basis for why we do an elimination diet in the first place. So before I conclude, I just want to share that it's not just the food allergies that we do elimination diets for. In some cases, it's whole families of foods that we might be eliminating for a while. For example, we might get rid of oxalates. We might get rid of nightshades because we're suspecting an intolerance, right? Salicylate-containing foods. So it's like that, but it's always done in a way that's temporary elimination of the good stuff that may be causing problems, a permanent elimination of the bad stuff that's damaging the gut lining, and then a gradual reintroduction. A lot of people go on these diets, the FODMAP diet, the SCD diet, the low histamine diet, and they're on them forever. They're on them for years. They shouldn't have to be on them for years. You're supposed to go off of them, do cleanup, do repair, and then retest. And that's where the provocation and understanding the provocation and having good forms and checklists and giving them really good instructions makes a huge difference. So this concludes the Food Principles module on elimination diets. I hope this was super helpful, and I look forward to hearing how you're applying this in your own practice with your clients.